Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Work is a big part of most of our lives. Even though many people look forward to retirement beginning on day one of their working lives and work hard to retire early, others identify themselves by their work and would feel lost without it. And then there are those for whom working is a financial necessity that sometimes makes retirement unthinkable. Perhaps that, and the fact that Americans tend to work longer hours and take shorter, less frequent vacations than others in the Western world, has extended the working lives of so many of us. President Biden is working well beyond the normal retirement age. Donald Trump, also well above that age, is running for president. Members of Congress, captains of industry, perhaps the person at the desk next to yours, are all working beyond the age of 65. So let's talk about retirement. How do you know when the time is right? What will the next chapter be like? What questions should you be asking yourself as you contemplate walking away from the daily grind? For that conversation, we're joined by Teresa Ghilarducci. She's professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York. She's also the author of Work, Retire, Repeat: The Uncertainty of Retirement in the New Economy. She joins us from California. Good morning. Welcome. It's very early there. Thank you for getting up. Dr. Megan Davenport is also with us. She is professor of psychology at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us. Good morning. And yeah. Charlie Locke is here. She's a freelance journalist who often writes about this topic in the pages of The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you for joining us as well, Charlie. Good morning.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you, Megan, as the psychologist on this panel. Why is it that some people do look forward to retirement as soon as they begin working and scramble to find ways to retire as early as possible, while others, like me, cling to their jobs well beyond retirement age when they don't have to, when money isn't the issue? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think one big thing there is how tied someone's job is to kind of their identity as a person, right? Some of us see work very transactionally, either because our job has never really been a good fit for us, or just because we hold other roles in our lives as more salient. And so, but others see their work as a calling, and it's central to who they feel like they are. And I think that is a big part of what retirement will mean to people.
Well, there's an old saying that says that do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. You'll also probably never make the money you would have made if you did what you didn't love. But is that part of it? Are there a lot of people out there who simply are doing what they love to do and can't imagine not doing it, Megan?
I think that is a big part of it. And maybe beyond whether your specific job is your dream job, this job you can't imagine leaving, your job might just afford you things that you don't know where else you would get them, right? That social interaction, that sense of I'm doing something productive, I get that sense of accomplishment from my job, right? So even if it's not this, you know, I can't imagine doing this job, anything but this job, it could just be that your job is giving you something that you're not sure where else you would get that.
So, Charlie, I once asked a friend of mine who was a producer at a major television network TV news show why so many of the people that you saw on that show were well beyond retirement age. They didn't need the money. They'd been there for years making lots of money. So they obviously were willing to put up with a grueling travel and deadline schedule to do what they did. Why do they keep doing it? And he told me that they see their friends behind the camera who have been there as long as they have, retiring one week and dying the next, and they don't want to be on that path. In your article about retirement in the July issue of The Atlantic, you begin with this sentence, quote, "For men like Joe Biden, highly educated, employed past 65, strongly tied to work, stepping away can pose its own risks to health and happiness." That seems to be tied in with what I just talked about. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you work a job where you really identify with the job, and again, that can be your dream job, you know, kind of a creative passion job, or it can just be something where you've spent your whole career doing this. You spend, you know, we spend most of our waking hours at work for a lot of our lives. And so if you really identify with that and you keep doing it into, say, your 80s, then there's often not a lot of other identity for you to fall back on once you do leave that job. And so once you leave the job, it's really important to have in place other aspects of who you are for you to kind of rely on for your own self-worth and for also just literally how you're filling your days, how you're finding meaning in your lives.
We're going to talk about this because you've talked to a lot of people on the verge of retirement and a lot of people who have retired. And I'm wondering how they feel about when they look back on how they have built their work life and how they have thought of themselves in the context either of work or out of work. Do they wish they had formulated a different identity over the years, that they had separated themselves somehow from what it is they do?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I wrote a story for the New York Times Magazine a couple months ago where I talked to people on their last day at work all across the country who were leaving their careers where they'd worked for a long time. And a lot of them talked to me about the regrets that they had around investing so much of their identity into their job. So people who felt that they had missed big chunks of their children or grandchildren growing up, people who felt that they had had to kind of focus on their work identity rather than showing up for their community, whether that means volunteering or having an active role in your church or your temple, kind of thinking of other ways that you can really be, derive a lot of identity outside of your professional life. I think people do often kind of have a reckoning with that once they leave behind their work identity.
Yeah, there's go ahead.
Yeah, I really want to stop everyone here for a little bit, because for years, especially in America, we've had this kind of conversation about what happens after you retire, that you'll drop dead right after you retire. And much of that is anecdotal. I learn a lot from journalists, but the sample is really not as selective. You know, it's very biased. And so what I did in my book is just look at tens of thousands, if not millions, of records, you know, to ask the question, why did people retire and what happened to them afterwards? And we found some regularity in the United States and in Europe based on their many, many characteristics. So if I could tell you from my methodology that much of what you say is kind of wrong, that for most people, even executives, retirement actually improves health and lengthens healthy life. Many people that you know who drop dead after retirement had an underlying health issue. And so you can't really untangle the reasons why they retired from the retirement event itself. But the one thing that we all can agree on is that for certain kinds of people, working is so delicious. And those are people that are on the top of the work hierarchy. So, you know, the people that we mentioned, Biden, the host of a major television program, well, they're the boss. And the boss brings very special kinds of health effects. You don't have the kind of cortisol levels and the stress levels, even though it's stressful and fast paced, when you're the boss, the top of the hierarchy, these Whitehall studies from the British administration and the government have really shown, and that shows up in the health and retirement survey from University of Michigan. If you're at the top of the hierarchy, work is best, but that's so rare.
Well, let's talk about being at the top of the hierarchy. We just witnessed a remarkable event in American life, and that is that President Biden decided not to run. Now, it could have been his decision. He could have been forced into making that decision. That's something that we'll leave for the history books to decide later on. But initially, at least, he was defiant until he wasn't about leaving that position. And you say that older individuals, Teresa, in positions of power are much less likely to retire. Being boss, especially at older ages, is fun. And you say that older people whose spouses continue to work, as President Biden's spouse Jill does as a professor at a community college, are less likely to retire. And yet, he did it, he says, for the good of the country. So do you think that he understands what this will mean for him on January 21st?
I think Megan and Charlie, you know, have a lot to say here. But yeah, I think what he did was one of the five tasks of psychological tasks of retirement is that he found meaning in the act. So there's five things you need to do before you retire, and that is to find meaning elsewhere. And he found meaning, and he told us what that was: for the good of the party, for the good of the nation. I'm doing this act. And so that really does help him. Another big pressure besides your spouse working and you being on the top of the hierarchy is that other people like you are not retiring. And that's a special American kind of disease. You know, since we don't have mandatory retirement in most places, we do for captains of industry. Many CEOs have signed an agreement that they will retire at 65 and 70. Jamie Dimon, head of Chase, of J.P. Morgan, is retiring, and he's around 65 or so. And that is, the board of directors will allow that. If other people in your peer group are not retiring, it's very hard to do it.
But when you walk away, you don't know what the future holds. You don't know what the future holds while you're working either, of course. But Megan, when you walk away and you're the most powerful person in the universe, which is Joe Biden, the president of the United States is allegedly the most powerful person in the world, and suddenly you're citizen Biden or you're citizen Trump or you're citizen so-and-so, how do you cope with that? What should he be doing? What should all of us be doing to prepare for that different identity?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very unlikely that President Biden will go from 100 to zero, right? I don't think that he will stop engaging, maybe just in a different way, in a different role. And I think we can all learn from that in terms of having some imagination, right? Like, what are the things that I really love about my kind of career and the job that I'm retiring from? And how can I structure, sometimes we call it bridge employment, right? Like this bridge from my kind of career job that I've retired from formally to not engaging in kind of work or public life at all, right? There's this bridge that we can imagine how we want to build. And I think having some creativity and just reflecting on, you know, what were the things that I loved about it? How can I make some of those things still true in either kind of volunteer work, part-time work, for many of us, kind of more of like a self-employment or a part-time structure can still afford us those things while having the flexibility that we need to either address health issues or just kind of having more time for those non-work things.
Working, though, working can keep you young because you have to keep your mind engaged and you have to keep up with the people who are behind you, who are, in fact, younger than you, who you're working with in the office. But then when you're the president of the United States, I don't care who you are, when you enter the office, you're younger than when you leave. And that's not just because you were there for 4 or 8 years. It's because the job truly, quickly ages you. So you're leaving that job probably less healthy than you were when you entered it. When we come back, I want to get into an argument here between Charlie Locke and and Teresa Ghilarducci about what President Biden might face, because there are concerns about cognitive decline and there are concerns about his physical decline since he entered that office. What kind of challenges might he face when he leaves that could be applied to all of us? We're talking about retirement or the prospect of it this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about retirement, how to get ready for it, why some people work well beyond retirement age, the economics involved with walking away from work, the psychological adjustments involved with walking away from work, with Megan Davenport, who is a psychology professor at UNC Charlotte. Teresa Ghilarducci is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research. And Charlie Locke is a freelance journalist who writes about this extensively for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and other publications. So we talked about Joe Biden deciding to leave, and many people are concerned about his apparent cognitive decline and his apparent physical decline since he entered the office of president. And he was asked about this in an interview, Charlie, about, I think it was Lester Holt asked him about a cognitive test. And he says, I take one every day. I take a cognitive every day because he has to make decisions to keep his mind sharp and alive as president. So what does he face when those opportunities are no longer part of his daily routine? Does he face a more quick cognitive decline if it's already begun?
I don't think I'm qualified to say whether Joe Biden's going to face a cognitive decline or not, but I do think that something that can be a challenge when people step away from the routine of a really high-paced career that they've been in for, say, 60 years, the way that Joe Biden has, is you really have to find other ways to keep yourself really plugged in and to find those kind of cognitive challenges and really build a full life outside of work. And a lot of what I wrote this recent story in The Atlantic about is that because of the way that we hyper-focus on work and career in the U.S., as Teresa was talking about, it's kind of a uniquely American disease to identify so deeply with the work that we do and work at it for so long. I think that we can over-rely on our jobs to keep us sharp in that way. And it's really important to build in other parts of your life where you are that can kind of hold you, keep you sharp, hold you responsible, and kind of keep you cognitively sharp like that once you do step away from the 10, 12 hour, 15 hour days that you've been putting in at a job that have that kind of rigor that keep you sharp like that.
We're talking about something that most people look forward to, most people will engage in at some point in their lives, and that is retirement. But there are people who maybe can't retire because of the economics involved in retirement. When that paycheck stops, that can be a significant problem for a lot of people. Teresa, I keep reading articles on how many people in this country have not sufficiently saved for retirement, and they find themselves living poorly on Social Security, which was never designed to be a complete income replacement. Do you know how large a subset of people that is?
Yeah, it's almost all people who earn below the median salary, so the bottom 50%. It's almost all of them, I mean like 90%. It's probably most of the middle class, and it's 10% of people who make over $120,000. So all in all, it's about 75% of people will not be able to maintain their living standards in retirement or stay above the poverty line. It's just shocking, and it has to do with the kind of pension reforms we had 40 years ago, where during the Reagan era, we put in place some methods that cut Social Security benefits, and we put in regulations and rules and really norms of behavior that made companies move away from defined benefit pensions or traditional pensions to nothing, or a do-it-yourself kind of pension called the 401k pension. And so people without a guaranteed flow of income for the rest of their lives to supplement Social Security, work becomes a way to stay in the defined contribution plan, the 401k, to keep on accumulating and also, to keep income coming. But the other thing looming in the last 20, 30 years has been long-term care insurance, because we're living a little bit longer. But Medicare, the Congress failed to put long-term care insurance into Medicare. And so people now know that they may live until their 90s and not have not have any way to get care.
So when I first started working, everybody had a pension plan. Your employer had a pension plan. And at some point, the company that I was working for at the time said, we're phasing that out and we're starting IRAs and 401ks that you can contribute to. And you get to control it. It's not some big boss in the sky saying, here's how we're going to invest the money that we're saving for you. You're going to do it yourself. And everybody thought, well, okay, that sounds good. And politicians made it sound good on one side of the aisle, at least. But why didn't people do it? Clearly, if people had done it, would they have had enough money at this point in their lives when this all started 40, 50 years ago? As they're approaching 65, would their 401ks be chock full? Or was it stacked against them? Because 401ks are subject to the vagaries of the economy, like recessions.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to be part of, you know, blaming the victim that some 25-year-old didn't start saving, you know, 7% of their salary the moment they, you know, lifeguarded. So, and it's a real American disease to blame the victim for not having enough financial education or enough willpower to save. Humans in Western democracies are all pretty much the same, but they don't face what Americans face in European countries, and even in Asia and developing countries, they have mandatory savings plans. So as soon as that you work, you start to save. So that was one big part of it, is that was voluntary on part of the employer, voluntary on part of the employee, and it goes against human nature. So we can't change the humans we have. We really need a structure that that accommodates the fact that people, you know, don't save for future events as readily as they save for current events. And also wages didn't grow for American workers for 40 years.
And we did not have this kind of financial education that is required if you really want to do it yourself and be an investor. Of course, there are financial planners out there who are fully willing to help you with this. But I remember when this first became a thing, all of a sudden we were doing talk shows on with financial planners talking about how to do this because no one knew how to do it. If you are in that position where you have been contributing to a 401k or you have been buying, putting money into a Roth IRA or a regular IRA every year, and you're approaching retirement age, Teresa, how do you know you have enough?
Yeah, that money. First of all, you could be doing all the right things because you had all the right education. But if you lose your job, you're kicked out of the 401k, you get another one and you have to wait 2 years. I was talking to an NPR host and they went to 4 radio jobs. But NPR, the station they were at, required 2 years before they could get back in. But you asked the question, how do people know the number? And I'm going to say something that's going to make everybody feel bad, and it makes me feel bad saying it, but you need about 10 times what your annual salary is in your early 60s in order to supplement Social Security and kind of be sure that you can maintain your living standards if you live average length of time. And like I know, only a handful of people even have close to that number. In fact, the median amount is about half your salary in your 401k. So I'm talking so professorial and authoritatively, you know, like a financial planner about how much you should have. And I sound like I'm blaming the victim, but you need 10 times. And that's even conservative. Some people say 15 times your annual salary by the time you're in your 60s.
So money is not the only consideration as to why people work beyond retirement age, Megan. As we've talked about, some people are just, they can't imagine not working. Their identity is all tied up in who they are at the office. When we go to a party, that's usually the first question a stranger will ask us just to keep the conversation going. What do you do? And if you don't do anything because you're retired, what do you say? Is that holding people back?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about kind of comparisons, right, to our peers. And I think beyond that, not just saying, well, do they have something to say at the party as well? I need to. I think beyond that, we also want to kind of have people to relate to, right? So if I'm the only one at the party saying that I'm retired, that might also be something where I feel then like or my peers who can understand this experience for me. But yeah, I think that that is part of it, and having something else to say, right? So if you're planning to retire, thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to be at that party in 5 years, what do I want to be able to say, right? Do I want to be able to say that I'm volunteering in some kind of meaningful way? Do I want to be able to say that I'm engaging with my children or my grandchildren in a different way than I currently am, and that I'm more involved there? Like, what do I want to be true? And then by the time you get to the party, you're able to have thought about that in advance.
And Charlie, in one of your articles, you quote Sarah Damask, who I hope I'm saying her last name correctly. She studies gender and labor at Pennsylvania State University, and she says that educated men in particular, for them, there is this expectation that your work is part of your identity. Who set that expectation? And how do you overcome it? Did anybody give you any tips on how to overcome that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the gender aspects of this are really interesting, and particularly when I've talked to people anecdotally, but talked to lots of sources about what it's like to retire, it's really interesting to observe some of the ways that there can be a gender gap there. I think that women are more likely, for various reasons, to have to kind of have a more robust identity outside of work, whether that's because they needed to step away to be a caregiver, or have kind of step back from work to be a caregiver to parents or to children, or just because women are often in heterosexual relationships in the US expected to kind of hold the social bonds where they keep track of, you know, dinner parties or family members' birthdays, kind of hold the friendships for the couple. And a lot of older men, when they retire, have a hard time figuring out what their identity is outside of work and kind of how to fill their time. I had numerous men in their 70s and 80s who I talked to who said, you know, I on the first Monday when I after I retired, I, you know, kind of looked around and couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do. My wife was going to her activities or hanging out with her friends, doing her life, and I kind of had to figure out how to fill in my time. And it was interesting to me, a number of older men I talked to really found that community through men's groups of building a community of men their age who were also going through this experience of retirement, of figuring out what their passions were and what they were going to spend their time doing. So even if you don't have the social network pre-existing of people who have retired and are kind of in that same phase of life, it can be a really valuable thing to seek that out, whether that's through a church or an organization, and kind of build that community for yourself to hold yourself accountable to it.
When does the building begin? That's the question, because we know this is happening. We know it's coming for most of us who don't die on the job, who will actually leave someday and be a retired individual. And you write about these people and their experiences, Charlie. But Megan, when should we start unraveling our identity from what it is we do at the office?
I think to your first point, right, there's actually a book by a sociologist called Mary Gatta. Dr. Mary Gatta, it's called Dying with Your Boots On, right? And it's about the fact that in certain industries, she focuses in that book on the restaurant industry and service workers. The assumption is that I'll never be able to retire, right? And so you kind of operate that way, thinking, well, that's not really even in my plan, just financially. But for those of us who are lucky enough to envision retirement and be able to plan for it, I think as soon as we can, right? So having a diverse group around you, having, to Charlie's point, different activities, different options, right, of people to engage with, things to do, the earlier the better that we can build a robust non-work identity that will then kind of help that transition.
Mike, I want to just, the research says something a little different. It's almost impossible while you're working and you are involved in an identity to really make up another one. And so many people don't, but it takes about, the research shows kind of a U-shape. It takes about a year for that kind of depression or going to the wrong parties. I mean, Megan really pointed out that reference groups really matter. Well, stop going to work parties and go to different kinds of parties or make your own parties. really alluding to the psychological task. So change your reference groups and give yourself some time to develop even new interests. You almost don't know who you are because you're working for somebody else. And when you start controlling the pace and content of your time, you also create a personal narrative about who you are. That's a psychological process. It can be help with therapists. That is actually could be a really good task to do. But you've got to figure out your routine. You've got to figure out how to protect your time against people who will really want it. That's especially true for women, because their work actually protects them from a lot of caregiving work. You have to figure out your identity. That's the other one. You have to do what Biden did, which is to figure out meaning. And the fifth thing you have to do is how you get your emotional regulation. I mean, I've never cried at work. I cry plenty on weekends, but not at work. You have to like hone yourself in. You're a different self at work. And so the research shows it takes about a year, but then the subjective well-being, your kind of sense of yourself and happiness goes up after a year.
You mentioned depression, Teresa, and I want to talk about this because you're the one that said the research is not necessarily correct in that we do not retire and then decline in health necessarily. And in fact, when you leave work, the pressures of that occupation are lifted from you. And some people thrive in that environment, but others, because their identity has been ripped away and their daily routine and the people that they associate with have been ripped away, fall into a depression. And we know that depression can lead to failing health. Is that avoidable? Can you avoid it?
There's two big things that really are coincident with that. One is not having enough money. So when you know people who fall into depression after retirement, you really have to ask, well, do you have enough money? I mean, it could be that. And the other one is whether or not you were forced out. If you have a feeling, so Biden is at risk if he was forced out. He might have been forced out in, 98 days because he did not have the kind of certainty that a tenured professor has. So he could have really been facing being forced out anyway.
Teresa, Charlie, when we come back, I want to talk to you because you've talked to some of these retired people and people facing retirement about what role depression has played for them. And if they did tell you that they were depressed, did they overcome it? And if so, how? We'll come back and get some answers to that and many other aspects of retirement. When we come back, we're talking to Charlie Locke, freelance journalist, Teresa Ghellarducci, who is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York, and Megan Davenport, psychology professor at UNC Charlotte. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about retirement today, what people face, the struggles that come with retirement, the joys that come with retirement, and now the depression that can sometimes come with retirement. Charlie Locke is a freelance journalist who writes about young people and older people on the verge of and having already retired for publications like The Atlantic and Newsweek, the New York Times Weekly Magazine, I should say, and other publications. When you talked to people who have retired, do they bring up depression, Charlie? And if so, do they talk about how and if they recovered from it?
I think less than depression, people have talked about the really, really hard mental adjustment, which is not strictly speaking depression. I think it's people who are feeling like there's a really, really hard transition out of work and figuring out what to do next. And I think that definitely has to do with what Teresa was talking about a few minutes ago around there kind of being I forget what word you used, Teresa, but there kind of being a year of hard adjustment for some people of figuring out what their lives are going to look like. I'm trying to think of examples. So for this Atlantic story I reported a couple of weeks ago, there was this man, Gary Givler, who's a retired Episcopal deacon in a small town in Ohio. He he retired and he really felt at loose ends for what to do, but realized that there, because he had been a deacon and kind of had this leadership role in his church, realized there were a lot of other men who he knew who were really at loose ends about what to do. He told me a lot of them tell me they'd give anything to have a reason to put a shirt and tie on and go somewhere for an important meeting, kind of trying to figure out what to do with their days and who they are. And so forming a men's group for him was really important for him personally, because he could kind of see this role, and also for these people who were in the group with him to help them kind of navigate that tricky kind of depressive period where you're trying to figure out what you're going to do. I do want to emphasize that I think that the subset of people I was talking about in that Atlantic article, of people who are really well-educated, have white-collar jobs, and are choosing to work into their 70s and 80s, are a very small subset of the U.S. population, and a lot more people have a really hard time with retirement because it's not a choice. And that's something I've written about before, like in the New York Times Magazine story I talked about from a few months ago, where many, many Americans are pushed out of their work, either because of layoffs, because of a recession, or because of COVID, or also because they physically can't work anymore. Like the book that Megan was talking about, for many, many people, you just can't work as a waitress or work in construction once you're into your 50s, 60s, 70s, and they're forced to step away from work without a financial safety net. And that can be really, really shaky, and is a much trickier mental health battle to go through.
Yeah, you've said, Teresa, that the retirement savings crisis in the United States is no longer looming. It is here now. And you've said that the retirement is increasingly becoming a luxury that many American workers cannot afford. With rising housing costs, medical expenses without pensions that buoyed previous generations, millions of older Americans, you say, cannot stop working. But what about that waitress? What about that construction worker who's physically just can't do what they did before because the job has worn them down? What do they do? You unmute yourself, Teresa.
So
go
sorry. Ahead. They can't retire and maintain their living standards, and many of them will fall below the poverty line. You know, we have many times higher the poverty rate that other countries have. We're using international standards, we're at 23% to 24% of older Americans are living in poverty, using international standards. Using our very tight conservative standards, it's about 10% or 11%. But internationally, one out of four are poor in America, where it's like 4% in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands really are like us. They're capitalists. They love the market. They have as much financial literacy as we do. They just have a very different pension system. They have mandatory savings, and they have a good safety net, and they have long-term care. So it's really our systems, not the people. So we are in a situation where we tolerate this huge deprivation among our elders.
Our systems, or as the medical community would tell you about our medical system, we don't have one. Our systems, or our lack of systems. Megan, if you're over, let's talk about a different aspect of this for just a second. If you're over 65 and you're still working by choice, in many cases, you're in a managerial position. You're in a position that pays a decent salary. And if you're not forced out because you're making too much money, you continue to do that, even though you can afford to retire. But you're also standing in the way of younger people who could take that position and could take that salary and use it in part to build their nest egg so they have a more secure retirement when the time comes. How should people in that position, still working, feel about that? Are they being selfish?
I mean, I think going back to what we were just talking about systems, right? I think the systems, or lack thereof, kind of force us, right, to have to be self-interested in order to try to set ourselves up for the potentially, you know, 40,
but I mean, if you, but
30,
if you're, but
years.
But if you're in the position where you have socked it away and you have enough to retire, and in retirement, you wouldn't even notice that the paycheck stopped because you've got enough. Are you doing others a disservice? Should you do what Joe Biden did for the good of the country and step down?
I think oftentimes salary is over too much of a focus when we think about what older workers are bringing to organizations, right? They have so much wisdom oftentimes that they've accrued through their whole career. And so thinking about how to make sure that while you are sitting in that chair, you are finding a way, if you are the organization, right, to figure out how that person can actually benefit all of their younger coworkers by sharing their wisdom, figuring out how to transfer that knowledge that sometimes can be really hard to articulate, but comes out in the big meeting, in the big presentation, right? That they have this lifetime of experience that they're able to draw on when they're doing their job that could actually be a real benefit to the people who are coming up in the organization. But if you just think about, yeah, they're making more money, they're taking up a seat, I think that's only one part of the equation where we can think about how to creatively use the strengths of our more senior people.
Charlie.
I think that another aspect of this that is interesting to me is how we just don't have a lot of roles like a kind of elder statesperson role in our society. And I think that when there are roles that you can have, like a kind of emeritus role in an organization or in an industry, it allows you to still contribute that expertise, but while kind of transitioning away from full-time work. And that's beneficial for everyone involved, right? Because for the person who is kind of transitioning away from work, it's a way of honoring their expertise and their experience in the field. And for the people who are just coming up in that field or are coming into those leadership positions, it's really enormously helpful and valuable to have that expertise and that sense of history of whatever field it is. But often we have these really sharp transitions into retirement, and it means that there's not a good way to kind of honor the history and the background. It's really hard to go from 100 to zero.
Go ahead, Teresa.
Yeah, just to answer your question, Megan and Charlie talked about older workers complementing the labor of younger workers. And so in many cases, the older worker is so good at attracting money or business or productivity of the company that without that older person, the company or the enterprise would be less and there'd be fewer jobs. So in some places, they're complements. But we've done some research in many other places. They are substitutes. They are blocking advancement. So it really depends. In higher education, where I and Megan and I sit, the emeritus is a really good place. But a lot of tenured professors are training new PhDs, training, and they never step away. So they're creating unemployed PhDs that's probably happening in our industry. And that's where it becomes kind of a moral imperative probably to stop either training PhDs or step away. So in some places they're complements, some places they're substitutes.
Work provides structure. It provides socialization. It provides something to do and a place to go every day. And when you walk away from that, that all evaporates like that. And I think that keeps a lot of people in some of these jobs. When they know they could retire, they have the financial resources to do so. And yet, why would I do that? What am I going to do all day? I can't watch daytime television. What am I going to do all day? In most cases, Charlie, and I know this is anecdotal, but you've talked to a lot of people on the verge of retirement and people who have pulled the plug. Is it a positive or is it mostly a negative experience for them? What have they discovered?
Yeah, I think that it is usually, if you are choosing to retire and choosing when you retire, it's a positive experience. I think there's often a hard transitional period. Maybe that's 6 months, maybe that's a year at first, but then it becomes a positive experience. As long as you are choosing when to do it because you feel like you have the financial resources to do that, mostly. And also you feel like you want to in terms of identity. But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people I talk to, there's a bunch of bucket list items that they want to do right after they retire, like go on some long trips or go spend a bunch of time with their children and grandchildren, or pick up a hobby that they've been interested in and take it really seriously. And there's often a period of kind of leaning hard into those bucket list items and then kind of figuring out what a new routine is. And so figuring out kind of recurring appointments or, you know, lunch dates, kind of regular things that they're doing to structure their lives after kind of a celebratory in-between period.
A lot of people get into the job market gradually over time. They take a part-time job while they're in high school, or they become an intern while they're in college to expose themselves to the work world. It's a transition into. We don't graduate from high school or college and take a job, most of us, immediately. Should the other way around also be a transition, Charlie? I know that you talked to Professor Mo Wang, who studies retirement at the University of Florida. Should this be a transition? Should you simply start cutting back on your hours after you're 65 and you want to continue to work, but you work less, 30 hours, 25 hours a week, so that you're moving into a new phase gradually?
I think for a lot of people, that can be a really good solution. I think that can look a couple different ways. That can look like you're kind of scaling back your hours at your place of employment. It can also look like thinking really carefully about a different kind of mentorship or contributory role that you will have after you step away from your career, like for a professional journalist to step away. When I retire, I would love to figure out a way to be mentoring younger journalists, to be giving expertise to newsrooms, to kind of have a really active role in this way, even if it's not about earning income in the same way, have a really strong structure of how I'm contributing for a little while, and then eventually maybe I will step away entirely from work. But I think that having that transition can be a really beautiful way of kind of remembering the value and honoring the career that someone has had.
Megan, it seems to me that once you take away the financial situation that you may or may not have, which we've talked a little bit about, and the emotional attachment that you may have to your identity or to your work and what you do and to the people with whom you work, are there questions that we should be asking ourselves as we approach a retirement age about how to go through this and about what we want on the other side?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think to Charlie's point, as we age, we know that what is most motivating to people tends to shift, right? We shift towards these more generative motives. Laura Carstensen out of Stanford has a lot of research on this. And so thinking about what is motivating to me, how can I get that feeling of giving to other people, mentoring, being generative, having those positive social experiences? How can I facilitate that for myself? And what are my strengths as well? And how can I maximize on those strengths, right? So back to our expertise point, expertise is not the only thing that might be a strength, but figuring out what am I really great at? What do I love to do? And then how can I kind of incorporate that into my plan?
When my father retired 100 years ago, he had worked for the same company his entire career. We didn't talk a lot about it, but I went to his retirement party and I was gratified to see how many people spoke at his party about the importance that what he had added to their lives. And it surprised me because he hated his job. He could not wait to retire. And yet he had this impact on other people. At least they were nice enough to say so. And I'm wondering, in this world where we don't hold jobs for 40 or 50 years, where younger people change jobs like I change my socks, is it easier to leave work after you retire from a series of jobs than it is if you had the same job at the same company for your entire career? Teresa, you're shaking your head. You're nodding your head.
I know that there isn't research exactly on that, but I do know that a lot of insecurity in your career can really make retirement, if you can afford it, a relief. That this job insecurity, I mean, young people change their jobs, but a lot of it, you know, could not be just choice. But this points to something. I want to point to my five characteristics, and the last one was emotional regulation. So it's, my characteristics can be remembered by prime: protection, routine, identity, meaning, and emotional regulation. And what you just described, and what Megan was describing, is that every day on the job, you get these kind of micro bursts of serotonin. Mm-hmm. You're told, hey, attaboy, did a good job.
And so, that goes away. So you got to find another way to supplement that. Teresa Ghilarducci is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research, along with being an author of Work, Retire, Repeat, The Uncertainty of Retirement in the New Economy. Charlie Locke, freelance journalist writing for The Atlantic. And Dr. Megan Davenport, psychology professor at UNC Charlotte. Thanks.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.